In this book, Patsy Sims says that she attended almost 50 services conducted by 15 evangelists and also interviewed countless revivalists, their families, people who work in their operations, and also audiences. And she says that after all of that, she can say that some of these men of God are not all good, but she says she would not venture an opinion as to which are good and which are not. She says rather her purpose in writing the book is to give readers an idea of what it's like to experience an old-time revival, to explore human needs and feelings and an institution that is so much a part of American and religious heritage. And I think the book does succeed in doing that. Patsy Sims is the author of several other books, including The Klan and Cleveland Benjamin's Dead. She is currently working on a novel set in a Texas prison farm, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Sims, hello.
Hi.
I think, as I said, I think the book really does succeed. I think you will, in reading this book, you almost manage to put people right there in the tent. I think you really get a feeling of what it's all about.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad it succeeded for you.
When you in the beginning of the book, you talk about some of your first attempts at finding revivalists, finding the kind of people that you were looking for, and I get the impression that it took you a little while to find what you thought was sort of the genuine article, and I'm wondering what qualifies for being a real revivalist in that sort of old-time mold.
Well, I think actually what happened was that, I had a preconceived idea of what an old-fashioned tent revival was like. And so when I set out going to services, they were very different from my preconceived idea, since I had never been to a Pentecostal service or, a Pentecostal tent revival. And so what really was happening was that I was indeed finding old-fashioned tent revivals, and I didn't realize it. And so some of the ones that I did go to in the beginning are included in, mm-hmm. and that I wrote in the book. It was just a matter that when I set out, I didn't realize it first. Mm-hmm. The music was so loud and lively, and a lot of the songs were different from the ones that I had heard growing up. And it was more of a performance, and so I kept looking for what I thought was more in line, what was more in line with my thoughts, but found out that I was very wrong about what they were really like.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned this kind of thing is part of a very old tradition that goes back really hundreds of years. So it must have some of the same elements. In some sense, it must be very much the same as it was 200 years ago, and yet also has a lot in it that is modern and contemporary. How does that blend work? What are the modern elements, and what are the
Well, I think the modern elements are probably, the introduction of amplifiers and, electronic music instruments, that aspect of it. And I think, probably another modern aspect is the public relations, the promotion, and more of the, sales pitch and emphasis on money. Of course, there's been an emphasis on money for a while, but some of the ways that it's done, I think, are probably some of the more modern mm-hmm. influences. And certainly, you had the introduction into these of radio and some of the larger ones, television, which they will take part of the services and end up broadcasting them. So you have some parts of the services. With the evangelist, bringing in the radio audience. So those are some of the modern introductions that I can think of.
Yeah. When people will hear us talking about this, I'm sure that right away they will start thinking about some of the more celebrated evangelists that have gotten into trouble in the past couple of years, people like Jimmy Swaggart and the Bakers, and perhaps also Oral Roberts. But I think one of the things that you do with the book is show that there's in a sense another end to this scale, mm-hmm. and that some of the people you talk to, they are certainly not wealthy. They are certainly not national celebrities, and they don't seem to be in it for the money, or at least when they do talk about money, the impression you get is that what they're trying to do is stay solvent. They're not really trying to get wealthy. And it seems to me this is a different end of the spectrum from those that we probably know a little bit better through the media.
Right. It is a different one. And, you know, I think the thing that I was trying to show, you know, obviously I started the book long before the Bakers ran into problems and swaggered. But I think a couple of things. A number of the people that people have heard about more, like the Bakers, Rex Humbard, you know, a lot of these folks started out in tents. And, you know, in a day when they were smaller and less prosperous, their services were perhaps more like the services that I have in the book. One of the reasons that I didn't include people like that, even before these problems started out, was that I felt like, we hear so much about these people that it would be interesting to find out about some of the other people. And, you know, I think that because these people are not as well known does not mean that they're not equally as interested, and actually I think that some of the people who are in the book are far more interesting than the people that we hear about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to talk about a few of these people. Why don't we start out talking a little bit about this man who is the first person you talked to, H. Wayne Simmons. What interested me is that he's, I don't know if you'd really want to say he's an amateur or a novice, but he's just sort of starting out, and he seemed to, for a number of years, have experiences in and out of religion, and really in a very almost painfully emotional way, wrestling with whether or not he should take it up full time and whether or not he had been really called to preach, and was one of these people, and perhaps there are many people who didn't go through a kind of formal religious training, didn't go to a religious college, weren't ordained in a formal way, but sort of took it upon themselves to do it, and perhaps served as an apprentice to someone else, or just kind of struck out on their own.
Yeah, in Pentecostal churches and in Pentecostal revivals, actually not having seminary training is very, very usual. I mean, that's really more the norm than somebody going to Bible college. And part of that is because the evangelist and actually even the churchgoers or revivalgoers themselves feel God himself calls the people, and when God calls somebody, that he will prepare them to preach and for the ministry. So they really don't feel that it's necessary for the people to go, you know, have formal training. There are exceptions, and you do have people who do go after they feel that they've been called. But it's a very, very common thing for somebody just to start preaching.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I mean, he really was very much a beginner, and that's why I did use him in the beginning of the book, because I was trying to show a real variety of people, that they're really a lot of different kinds of people out on the sawdust trail, so to speak, and I thought it was kind of appropriate to start out and introduce the readers to the subject and to the book with someone who really was sort of, you know, virtually starting out and who was really nervous.
In the book, there's a quote that I've written down here, and I guess I have to admit I'm not sure if it's something that you say in the book or something that actually he says or someone in his group says, that the first night of a revival was always the hardest.
Those were sort of his words. I think that perhaps I paraphrased, but he did talk about that, about how it always was the hardest, and you were more nervous, and you really hadn't struck up a rapport with the people, and I think that's probably true in a lot of fields, that, you know, you're always more nervous in the beginning, but I think a lot of times we don't think of that as being true with an evangelist, he felt it was, and I think he probably was right, not just for himself, but for other people, too.
How was his preaching, his presentation? It seemed that the reaction of the crowd in this particular case was, was maybe polite, but not exactly enthusiastic.
Yeah, well, you know, he was very stiff, and I think that he was very stiff because he was nervous and self-conscious. And so, you know, feeling that way, that he wasn't really doing a good job of preaching. And certainly, I heard a lot better sermons and a lot better services than his first ones, and maybe even, you know, all 2 weeks. But, you know, the people were, as you said, you know, being polite with him, but were not really responding like they do at a lot of the revivals, and I think like the people really like to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And I did see, as the time went on, I did see him loosening up a little bit. And as he loosened up and became a little sure of himself, you know, his preaching improved, and the response of the audience improved a lot, too. It'd be interesting to hear him preach now, today, to see, you know, if he's changed.
How did he cope with the? I mean, he must have had in him somewhere some small sense of discouragement that it somehow wasn't what he hoped it would be. In fact, there's one point where he the second night he's arranging the chairs and lets you in on this little trick that early on in a revival you spread the chairs out so it looks like there's more people, and then as you get more people you can put the chairs closer together and put more chairs in there. So it's sort of like doing everything you can to make it appear that the crowd is a little bit bigger than it really is. His brother was in there sort of almost as a cheerleader, trying to get the crowd going as he was preaching. Somehow he must have said inside himself somewhere that, well, you know, this isn't quite what I had in mind. Mm-hmm. How does he deal with those feelings of perhaps disappointment?
Well, I think he more sort of explains them away, that, you know, that this happens, and you know, when it's God's time, you know, for it all to come together, you know, it will happen. I think that he and a lot of these people in a lot of different situations rationalize both to outsiders and to themselves about things. And I think that that's the way that enables them to keep going and not to get so discouraged by things, that this is to teach him something and that he will learn some kind of a lesson from this that will ultimately make him better, I saw not just with him in his reaction to the crowd or to the response and that type thing, but in healing services and other situations where when somebody obviously was not healed, them, you know, rationalizing and giving excuses as to why they were not healed, you know, why God could not permit them to be healed, or, you know, one thing or the other. And I think, you know, it's sort of a defense mechanism that, or, you know, sort of a survival technique or whatever you would want to call it, I think.
This morning on Focus 580, we're talking with Patsy Sims, author of a recently published book entitled Can Somebody Shout Amen? Inside the Tents and Tabernacles of American Revivalists. And it is about revivalism in America, contemporary America. She's talking with us this morning, and we'll talk with you as well. Perhaps you have some questions or some thoughts to offer. 333-WILL here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-WILL. Do you think that the people that you talk to, the evangelists that you saw, are conscious, or perhaps how conscious are they of the fact that they are giving a performance?
I think probably some more than others, but I think that most of them are conscious that they are giving a performance. They're conscious. They might not call it a performance, but they, you know, they're conscious of things that they can do and that they need to do to draw the congregation into the service and to get them to, you know, to participate and to respond. There is one section or one passage in the book where I'm talking to H. Richard Hall from Cleveland, Tennessee, And we talked about whether he knew what he was going to preach, you know, the topic when he came to a service. And he was a very frank, open man and you know, talked quite candidly. And he said, no, that he didn't, that he, you know, might have a couple of ideas of possible titles. But, you know, he said he never knew what was going to really fly, so to speak, with the crowd. And so he would talk a little bit along one area, and then he would go to another area. And he would be watching the audience for its response. And when he felt, when he had hit on something that he saw was really getting the audience's attention, then that would be the thing that he would pursue and he would really focus on and then go all out in preaching for that. So I think that he was more candid in talking about these things, but I think that when you're sitting in the services and you see the way the evangelists conduct the services, I think that you know, you have to feel that they are aware to a great extent of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about Simmons' brother being sort of a cheerleader. This is a really very big, important part of the service of having what they call a front man. And this is what Simmons himself calls this person, who comes out before the evangelist and leads singing and gives testimonies and little talks and really warming up the crowd and getting them into a good responsive disposition so that when the evangelist does come out that they are really ready to give him a big response and, you know, to follow and get involved with the sermon and, you know, both the sermon and also, you know, with the offering.
Mm-hmm.
And in the chapter on Ernest Angley, I think that's very, very noticeable in this one particular service in Washington where they spent, his singing group sang and conducted, you know, songs and solos and whatever for a long period of time, really warming up the crowd so that when Angley finally came onto the stage, you could hardly hear what the person was saying who was announcing him. So that, you know, you could see them really, I think they're really good communicators.
Hmm. One of the things that is really striking in the book is the way people talk about their tents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, there is a certain really something very romantic about it. And people talk about them with such pride in the various tents they've had and... What is it that, you know, that makes that such a special piece of equipment and gives them such a special feeling? I mean, even the people who are just delegated to keep an eye on things during the daytime when nobody's around, somehow the fact that they've been designated to be the tent watcher is some kind of great honor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, that... you know, part of it is that, you know, it is sort of a nostalgic, romantic part of American religion, you know, and it has this long tradition. So there's this tradition that they can see themselves as being a part of. And I think that because, you know, a tent is so big, well, I mean, you can have small ones and, you know, all sizes, but because it does stand out, I mean, it even stands out if it's in an area with buildings. You know, it stands out, and I think that there's a lot of pride attached to being able to look at that tent sitting there and to say, that's my tent, you know, that belongs to me, or, you know, as someone said, God gave me that tent, you know, that's mine, and not everybody has a tent. I think there's a pride in knowing that you're really sort of special that, you know, that you have this tent, and I think... again, the tent manager and the people who put it up, that they, you know, they really like tent revivals. And, again, it gives them a lot of pride to be able to feel when you have a tent revival, especially if it's gone well and it's been successful and a lot of people have come forward during the services, to feel that they had a really big part in, you know, making that revival possible, you know, with their efforts.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and there's somebody in the book, and I don't now recall who, but talks about how the atmosphere in the tent is different than it is in church,
mm-hmm.
And it does seem to be that it gives it sort of an almost gritty, earthy quality to the whole thing, that it somehow is more down to earth, more that it has a certain, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is.
I think that the people, I think everybody is a lot more relaxed. The person you're talking about is R.W. Schombach. And he talks about how people, you know, when they go to a church, they will get all dressed up and they will be a little bit stiffer than they might be, for instance, in other, you know, circumstances. But when they come to a tent, you know, that they sort of let their hair down and, you know, they feel like they can come a little bit, dressed a little bit more casually, and they really just sort of let themselves go and say and do things and maybe sing a little bit louder than they would in a church, and not be so uptight. And I think that's part of it. At least that was his feeling, that was part of it. And he also felt, I mean, I think that he could not exactly put his finger on it, but that there was this excitement. And maybe it's because an excitement that we attach to tents, you know, just tents. Period. I mean, circuses and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he did sort of liken it to a tent, and you don't have the calliope, and there were times, and I felt like when you're walking up to a tent and the people are, you know, congregating and everybody's arriving and there's a lot of excitement, that, you know, you could almost hear a calliope playing. There are a lot of different things, and I think, you know, a lot of it is association, things that we associate with tents and other, perhaps other experiences that we've had with tents.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit earlier about this first man that you talk about in the book, the one who was just kind of starting out, H. Wayne Simmons. And you talked with him about his past and his childhood. And he says at one point that, he was very troubled as a teenager, and says that at one time he felt that if God hadn't saved him, he'd either be in jail or he would have murdered someone. And several people in his family had been murdered, and he had, you know, he seemed to have quite a checkered past. And as I read through the book, it seemed that many of these people do. I mean, that they, and I don't know if perhaps they, to emphasize the drama of their change, maybe they're overselling their evil youth a little bit, but it does seem that many of them do, you know, come out of this very troubled youth. And a lot of them, you know, talked about how they drank and how they would get into trouble and were violent and did just about every sin that there was in the book. Is that sort of embroidering on their childhood, or do
well,
they
I
really...
think that, you know, I found it both ways. I found that there certainly are some people who had checkered past, and actually some who continued having questionable behavior. I mean, such as the late A.A. Allen, who had a drinking problem really all his life and died of cirrhosis of the liver, and was arrested for drunken driving several times. But I certainly did find that there were people who did emphasize their past and made it sound more sinful than it was, because I think that that sort of made them big in the eyes of their followers, that they had such a bad past and they had overcome it. And I mentioned in the book, and another writer had called the prodigal son syndrome, sort of talking about, you know, picture themselves as a prodigal son who, you know, repented and became a man of God. So that I think there, for instance, there's one passage in the book where I talk about R.W. Schombach, and he was talking about when he was saved, you know, what a big sinner he was. And when I started pushing him on, well, what had you been doing? You know, had you been, he said he had hung out with a gang. And I said, are you talking about a gang like, a street gang in Pennsylvania or in Philadelphia, you know, some of the places that we've heard of street gangs? Mm-hmm. He said, no. He just was talking about the young men that he ran around with. And said they were always getting in trouble. And I said, well, you know, were you arrested? No, I was never arrested. And, I mean, it went on that you really got the feeling that he was no more than a mischievous little boy or young man. But, when he would tell the story, when you you know, before you got around to pushing him on it, you would have thought that he had been really this very, very horrible person.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that there definitely is this tendency to exaggerate how bad and how sinful you were.
This morning on Focus, we're talking with Patsy Sims about her book, Can Somebody Shout Amen?, a book about revivalists in America. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and we are talking this morning with author Patsy Sims about a book that she's written, Can Somebody Shout Amen? It is about revivalists in America. It's published by St. Martin's Press. She spent almost 6 years traveling around the country, going to revival meetings and talking with evangelists, talking with their followers, the people that help them in their operation, talking with people who attend these, and put together the book that I really think it gives you an idea about something about what the people are like and what it is that motivates them and what it is like to go to something close to an old-fashioned revival. If you'd like to talk with us, of course, that's possible. That's invited, encouraged. If you have comments or questions, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. The thing about revivals is that they kind of come and go. They come to town, they set up for a while, and then the tent goes down and they go someplace else. And I wonder whether you think that the people who go to the revivals, are they going to them kind of like they would go to a movie or to the county fair? Is it an evening's entertainment, or is it more than that? Do the effects stay with the people long after the tent is packed up and gone?
Well, I think that they go. I think they go for both reasons. And, you know, of course, that varies. I mean, there's some people who obviously go out of curiosity or, you know, entertainment. But I think probably the bulk of the people, you know, go for religious fulfillment. But the entertainment part of it is certainly a big part of it, also. And in a drawing card for a lot of people, in many ways, a revival provides a form of entertainment that is acceptable to these people. I mean, a lot of the people who go to Pentecostal fundamentalist revivals are very strict in their religion, and an awful lot of things that are considered sinful and that they shouldn't do. And in life that is so strict, a revival becomes a form of acceptable and non-sinful entertainment. You have, very lively, good music that is not like, rock and roll, for instance, that, has lyrics that would be questionable to them. They don't believe in dancing, but at a revival, they can dance in the spirit, and twirl around. They can pat their foot. It's something that they can really enjoy and not feel bad or ashamed or, like that they've committed a sin. So, it is, the entertainment part is a very real part of it. And, it's something that really, all the way back to the Great Revival along the frontier, people came to the revivals partly because of the entertainment, something to do.
Well, we have a caller here. Perhaps we'll have some others. Why don't we find out what's on the mind of this person here on our first line? Let me give you our phone number again. It's 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Here we have a caller on line.
Good morning.
Hi.
I had a couple questions or thoughts to discuss about. One was from your discussion, were you, I was thinking of like for example, in the Catholic Church, there are the clothing that the monks and nuns used to wear for centuries. These things must have been new in their time, but they were just kind of preserved. And then I was thinking like the Amish people, they have certain ways of dress and living that they're trying to preserve something that was new in its time, but then they didn't want to lose it or something. And I just was wondering if you had that impression that these customs, which were perhaps sometime new in the past, I don't know, 100 years ago, and now they're trying to just not lose that, whatever it was.
You mean the revival and not close?
Yeah, the customs.
I think that probably, you know, in some places that it is a matter of wanting to maintain and preserve this, you know, form of worship that goes back so long. I think that is, you know, something that some of them probably do consider. I think they also do it just because they certainly enjoy that kind of service. But I did run into at least one situation comes to my mind here in Washington, D.C., where a very, you know, urban congregation decided one summer, just out of sentimentality, to borrow somebody's tent and hold a three-week revival. And they all enjoyed it so much that the church decided to buy a tent. And, you know, every summer they have a revival with it. And that really was started out as a, you know, sentimental thing in a way to preserve it. So I would say, yeah, that does enter into it sometimes.
Do you know whether this was like the early American frontier when it began? I mean, they didn't have circus tents, maybe.
Yeah, it did. We had revivals before that, but really what the services, you know, the services that now evolved from were more the services along the frontier. And, of course, they didn't have tents then. You know, there were the days of the brush arbor, but really the prototype for this type of outdoor service really came from those days and that time along the frontier.
Are you observing this, like, as a sociologist or...?
I am a journalist. I worked for newspapers for many, many years, though I've been a writer of books for a little bit more than 10 years. So I really am not a sociologist. I like to write about people and to study people, but I'm by training a journalist.
So it's news.
Soft news, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. Okay, well, then the second point, in my personal reading of the Acts of the Apostles, which I feel was written to kind of give a case history of the early start of Christianity, I just don't get the impression that these kind of things were carried on. I read about how the apostles tried to tell people what they believed and where the beliefs came from, and then usually the other people got, if they just said the wrong thing, they mobbed them. And I just felt in looking over that Acts of the Apostles that they were more of a teaching, going around trying to get people interested in their teachings rather than to revive them. Is this revival sort of within the church rather than going out into the world?
Yeah, a revival can attract all sorts of people, but generally it does have a tendency to attract more people who are already members of a church or involved in religion.
So that's
so
what
it's more of, you know, reviving their religious fervor.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then the third point I had was that I, in doing a little research, I noticed like in the Middle Ages, there were certain ones like they were called some sort of Baptists, and they were very sensible and in a lot of their teachings, and then they got killed off by their enemies, and then other ones that took over were more, I don't know what word to use, wild, and they'd take over cities and start violent fighting back against their enemies and so on, and just changed the whole nature of their original start. And I was just thinking, it made me wonder where these customs come from. You know, they weren't originally there. Do you have any inkling where these revivals were? Was it just somebody's invention and let's try this?
Well, revivals. I go back. I'm sure that they go back even before this country. I think that they probably are things that I'm not a historian, so I'm often left field. But I would say before what we know of is the Great Revival and the Great Awakening and all in this country. That I'm sure that there were times that people. you know, perhaps decided to have some kind of a revival type service. Uh-huh. I don't know. I don't recall that, you know, Christ or the apostles said, let's have a revival, but, you know, I think, you know, it's not necessarily something that the Bible said you should have a revival, but that just sort of sprang out of religious belief and practice.
Well, thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you for the call. We'll be here for about another 15 minutes talking with journalist Patsy Sims about her book, Can Somebody Shout Amen? And if you have questions or thoughts, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the one, perhaps the oddest chapter in here, or at least it seems that way. Perhaps it's the one that's the most out of the mainstream, the most closed community, and that is your visit with the snake handlers. You went to a church, and perhaps people have heard about this, where they have this tradition of handling poisonous snakes and also of drinking poison, sort of as a, I guess it's as a test of faith. And you seemed as you were going to this place, and it seemed like you maybe weren't quite sure where you were going and how you would be received, and were genuine. You seemed genuinely afraid. What were you feeling at that point?
Well, I was very nervous. I think I probably was apprehensive about how they were going to react to me. I don't mean that I felt they were going to do anything physically to me, but I was, you know, they had such I knew that they were very withdrawn people. They don't mix a lot in the outside world. And, you know, obviously it was a very different religious practice. And I was really very nervous about how they were going to greet me. I think the other thing that I was nervous about was that while I was there, somebody would pick up a snake, be bitten, and die. Or, you know, the other thing was that in this particular church, two people had died from drinking strychnine a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was nervous that, you know, I guess I was more apprehensive about that even than the snake handling. You know, I frankly just didn't want to see anybody die. And that was, you know, what I was really most nervous about.
Mm. And so you didn't, in the time that you were visiting with these people, you never did see them do snake handling?
No, I did see them.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I didn't. I was there for a week, and I had always been in an impression when you talk about snake handlers that they always handle snakes at their services, which they don't. I mean, it depends on whether they have them or not and whether they feel like God is telling them to handle the snakes. That particular week, most of the week, they did not have snakes. It was not until the last two nights that they had them, but they did indeed have snakes that weekend, and various people picked them up and handled them. The first night that I was there, I looked up on the pulpit, and there was a jar with clear liquid, which I took to be strychnine, which was indeed strychnine. Unfortunately, nobody drank any of it during the whole week that I was there, but they did handle the snake. Mm-hmm. These people literally interpret some chapters in Mark which say that those who believe in God will be given the power to pick up deadly snakes and drink harmful poisonous substances and not be harmed. There are other parts of the verse, but they literally interpret that. And what they feel is not so much that it's a test of their faith, though you get variations on how people interpret it. Most of the people, I think, interpret it more that because they are believers in God and they believe that God can do this, that God is really giving them the power to do this. Mm-hmm. So that when they pick up the snake, they're really demonstrating to onlookers what God can do, what he has power over to do.
Now, I'm sure that, as you say, in this particular church sometime before, two men had drunk strychnine and had died, and that I think various people that you talked to talked about the fact that they knew someone who had been bitten by a snake, or perhaps they had been in a service where someone had been bitten. And what happens when, you know, when someone drinks the strychnine and dies, how do they understand that?
Well, this is an excellent example of what I was talking about a while ago about justification and rationalization. And, you know, they will rationalize and say, I did not wait for God to tell me to pick up the snake. You know, he was not ready for me to pick it up. Therefore, I got, you know, bitten. Or sometimes they will say, God lets it happen every now and then just to convince onlookers and skeptics that the snakes are indeed deadly and that they can kill. And, you know, on and on. I mean, they give various reasons and rationalize why, you know, this was allowed to happen or why this happened. And I think that the rationalization is really very important to them and to these people, not just the snake handlers, because their religion is so central to their lives and, you know, their beliefs. Their whole lives are wrapped around this religion. It's not just a Sunday morning, you know, worship thing. And I think that if they were not able to believe, I mean, if this, because somebody died from a snake bite and they didn't believe it anymore, it would really end a very central part of their life. You know, they would be left with a real void in their life. So I think that, you know, part of this rationalization is to be able to preserve that belief.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody know exactly how this tradition got started or where it got started?
Well, it started about right after the turn of the century in Tennessee, over near Chattanooga in the, you know, in the mountainous area. A guy named George Hensley was reading the Bible and really felt that he wanted to see if, you know, God really wanted people to handle snakes, if he really meant this literally. And so he went out on a nearby mountain, found a snake and handled it and wasn't bit. So he felt that that was a sign from God, that, you know, God wanted his people to take up snakes. And he went back to his community and his church and was able to convince, you know, a lot of the other people that they should, you know, take up snakes. To show the power of God. And so he really is the one who started it and went around to other areas and other churches, encouraging people to take up snakes. So that was really where it began. And today it is mostly done in mountainous areas. And it is illegal in every state except West Virginia. But it, the authorities sort of ignore this, and people, you know, there are churches in Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, West Virginia. I can't remember now, but maybe a little bit less than a dozen states where there are scattered churches.
Mm-hmm. You have written another book, and I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you have written another book about the Ku Klux Klan, and in this book, in Can Somebody Shout Amen, you talk about the fact that as you were looking at the people around you that were attending these revivals, that you saw some similarity to those people that you had seen at Klan rallies, although that you say the people were there for very different kinds of reasons. I wonder, you know, after having the experience of doing the research and writing the two books, that somehow, you know, those two experiences are the, you know, the two sides of the same coin, so to speak.
Well, I think that you know, you see in the people, the common thing that I saw was in terms of education, socioeconomic status, because for the most part, the people who came to the revivals, like the people who tend most often to join the Klan and go to Klan rallies, people with not a great deal of education, not much money. They tend to have fairly hard, spare lives. And, I think that there is in both groups, a looking and a longing for something, to feel important, which the religion and going to the revivals, you know, gives it to these people just as it does going to the Klan rally. I think seeing the similarities in backgrounds and their station in life, I think the reason that it struck me was that because these revivals are very integrated, And there's a lot of outpouring of interracial love in these revivals, and I felt that it was really fascinating to me to see people who had come so much from the same stations of life, and you know, I felt that many of these people were related to people who I had met at Klan rallies, and yet you had you know, one group who went the route of hate and to find the fulfillment that they felt that they needed in their lives, while these other people were drawn to a, you know, really, the, as you say, the other side of the coin, a very loving form of religion that, you know, is very demonstrative. Most of the revivals that I went to were integrated to some extent, you know, some more than others, and the evangelist would always be saying, you know, turn around and tell the person next to you, I love you, or you're beautiful, that type thing. And, you know, you'd see these people turning around, blacks and whites, hugging one another, and, you know, it was really, to me, quite striking to see people who, you know, had to be related, or, you know, similar backgrounds as the Klan people, but yet were in so much more positive situation.
One of the people that you talk about in the book is an evangelist named Ernest Angley, who is really, you know, we talked quite a bit at the beginning about Wayne Simmons, who is just a very small time kind of guy and just starting out. Ernest Angley is really big time, and seems in a way to be kind of an unsavory character. At least you know, some last year I had a chance to interview James Randi, who has written a book about faith healers. You know, he is a magician and investigator of claims of the paranormal. And Angley is one of the guys that's in Randy's book that he really, Randi says, is really an out-and-out fraud, and says that he is one of these people that is that's making a living off of the misfortune of others and causing a lot of misery. And I wonder if, you know, if you, I think in the book you do maintain a fair degree of journalistic objectivity, and you say in the beginning that it's really not your desire to want to say some are good and some are bad. But I wonder, you know, what's your sort of overall feeling about these people and what they do is about, you know, whether they're doing good or maybe not doing good.
Well, you know, I think that varies. I think that that some of the people I felt were very genuinely motivated, and that they really were trying to help, and that, you know, that people did go away from their services you know, feeling better. I think in terms of Angley, I think perhaps of the people I met, he was the person who put me off the most, and I really felt that his emphasis on money and the way that he went about getting that money, I found it really very distasteful, and I would have to say that I did feel that he was preying on you know, the people's misfortune. You know, I would see him just milking these people for money. And you knew that these people had worked very, very hard for that money, and that a good many of them were going to have to do without something because of the money that they were giving to him and to his ministry. So, I found him very, very distasteful mm-hmm. in that regard. So, yeah, I think that there are some people who do take advantage of people, and I find it very questionable. You know, what they're doing and the tactics they do to raise money. One of the things that I heard or saw done was the hundredfold blessing, where an evangelist would say, God told me that, say, for instance, 25 people tonight will pledge to give, you know, $100 to this ministry. And all those who get up tonight and give $100 or a down payment on the $100 or a promise or whatever, and sign cards, you know, pledging that in 30 days, 90 days, whatever time frame, we'll get that money back a hundredfold. And this was told with elaborate ceremony and stories. And you know, you would see these people who were maybe domestics, janitors, you know, people who worked very, very hard, who didn't have much money, and you would see their eyes brightening up, you know, lightening up, mm-hmm. you know, that they were going to get all this money. And I felt it was really taking advantage of that. I thought that was one of the things that was just appalling. On the other hand, you know, I had other people like, you know, Paul, who I mentioned earlier. And this man slept in his car. He would not rent a motel room when he was on the road because he felt that was money they could use for other things. And I went to a number of his services, and he would always take up the offering the very last thing. And, you know, we're talking about a 4 or 5 hour service. So that a lot of people, you know, some people would have already left by that time. And it was very low key, fairly low key offering. And, you know, I heard him say to people, you know, if they were pledging to give so much money to his ministry, he would often say, now listen, if when it comes time to send in the second check or whatever, if you need that to buy a pair of shoes or, you know, whatever, you know, for God's sake, tear up the envelope. You know, you don't need an evangelist down your back. So, you know, I offer those as you know, the two extremes that you know, you have your Halls and you have your Angelies.
At any point, did you feel like the Spirit was seizing you and you wanted to somehow get involved? Did you ever feel that much drawn in?
No, I didn't. I a lot of people want to know that. I think that, you know, I went about this like, you know, as a journalist, and you know, perhaps that's why I didn't you know, feel moved to go forward or whatever, but no, I didn't.
Well, that we'll have to leave it. It's a very interesting book, and I'm pleased you could spend some time talking with us about it.
Well, I'm pleased that you had me on the show. It was good being with you.
The book that we have been talking about is entitled "Can Somebody Shout Amen?" Inside the Tents and Tabernacles of American Revivalists, and the author is Patsy Sims. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. We'll take a break now, as we do this time of day, and have a market update and some news headlines. And when we continue with Focus 580, we'll be talking about helping victims of violent crimes. Our guest will be Melinda Cook from the State's Attorney's Office here in Champaign County, and Dr. Marlene Young. She's Executive Director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance.